Welcome to Byte Action Podcast. For those who don't know, Byte Action Podcast is on a mission to bring you raw and filtered journeys of experienced and influential people in video games and creative tech industries. If you want to understand how games are made, who are the creators behind your everyday entertainment, and what it takes to build successful companies, games, and products, then you should give this a listen. Tell me about yourself, maybe just to start with, like who you are, what you do, a little bit about your profession, and we can go from there.
So I'm Vadim. I'm 37 years old, I guess, if I'm not mistaken. And I like to say about myself, I'm gameaholic. You know, it's like the alcoholic, but I have an addiction to games, to be honest.
Okay, nice. What do you play?
Everything that I could. So I think it just an so every game is just like an experience, and I try to, you know, get as much experience as I can, because in the end of the day, it's really hard to invent something new, and like still like an artist. So I think it's really important, not only for like for the game industry or for everyone to have, you know, own library of something, of like decisions, mistakes, experiences. So yeah, I try to play a lot, and you know, I'm more focused now on the like on the mobile games, because so yeah, we jump to the fun part, but let's keep it boring. So I'm currently a game director on the action shooter game. It's like the mecha action shooter about the mechs, the PvP game. So you can play with your friends, you can assemble your like build, you can put the chassis, the weapons to this mech, you can assign the pilot and go and kill someone. And in general, at my position, I'm responsible for like for the product vision, for the product growth. So to be honest, I'm not managing resources. I'm more about the product, and I'm like in the middle of many disciplines, let's say. So mainly I focus on like the game design, the live ops, the UX, but also I need to be aware of the analytics, of the marketing.
Right, okay.
Of like, I don't know, the relations with platforms, with like, for example, Apple and Google, because in the end of the day, we all want to be featured somehow and to get, you know, free viral traffic, because it's super crucial in our business. So yeah, that's my current position. In general, I think I fell in love with the games since I think 6 years old. I was a lucky guy. My father was like a programmer. Originally, I'm from Ukraine, from Kharkiv.
From Kharkiv, okay.
Yeah, it's like the eastern city near the border with Russia. So it's not a political podcast, but guys,
yeah,
the war is not over if you can't support Ukraine, because we're fighting for our freedom.
For sure.
And we're defending the Europe and like democracy and the people rights. So every day is like civilian casualties. It's really,
I mean, I think a lot of people know where Kharkiv is nowadays.
Yeah. So yeah, unfortunately, you know, the war is not over. So if you can just support Ukraine. So yeah, as I said, I was a lucky guy. My father was a programmer. And also, it's a bit of a shame to tell it, but I was born in a post-Soviet Union country, and the piracy was like really, really great. I think I played official licensed game, I don't know, in 2000, but I started playing like in 1992, maybe. So, and
how would you get the games?
So when I started, it was like the, you know, the diskettes, the small one. It was a strange story. So my father worked in the Kharkiv National University of Radio Electronics. I finished this university also. And he studied programming there. And he worked after he finished the university also there. And there were a lot of PCs that were brought like from different countries. I don't know where they get them, but sometimes there was games at the hard drive. So sometimes we get something new, like it was a surprise and everyone is copying everything.
Yeah.
But like in the middle of 90s, we already like have internet in 1995. I think I have internet in 1997 at home. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Pretty early for...
I don't know. Like for my country, it's really, really early.
Like I'm from Lithuania originally.
Yeah.
And I remember having internet maybe 2001, 2002, the first time.
So yeah, I'm a lucky guy, as I said. So yeah, it was a dial-up. It was like awful, really awful speed. So,
yeah.
And it was, I can say, dark days of the internet. I think it was really, really bright. Everyone is like, was open and so happy. And it was not so much of, you know, advertisement and stupid stuff in the internet. But yeah, on the one hand is internet. And on the other hand, we all have this, you know, black markets, bazaars, where they sell the... So then CDs came out. There's the technologies and it started becoming super popular. So we have a lot of like pirate CDs for like really, really cheap amount of money. And I think I consider it like as a huge benefit for me because I have an opportunity, I had an opportunity to play a lot of games. So yeah, I think that's why I can call myself a gaming-aholic, you know, because I love the game so much. I even like skip school to play the games. I have a PC and then we have this like internet clubs, but like it's clubs with the PCs when you can hang out with your friends.
Play and Warcraft.
Yeah, whatever. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Play like Counter-Strike and everything. So, and one of the clubs were opened at my school. Like, and they have some agreement with the school that they will open the club, but they will like run some PC educational program there. But it was like one room, but in the other room was like the school boys and girls that are skipping school and playing for the, you know. So yeah, it was a crazy time. But what I'm trying to say is I can consider this time and my childhood with all this piracy as really, really huge benefit that give me opportunity to, you know, to touch a lot of masterpieces. And I'm not sure that I have I would have this opportunity if I was living in like some, you know, European or USA.
Sure.
Because the games are obviously not cheap, let's say. So, and back in the day was I was in a school.
Oh, and they felt even more expensive. I remember going to the shop as well with my parents and my dad, like looking at those games and thinking like, how can anyone afford it, you know, being like 11, 12 years old? Yeah.
So, and now I think we're living in the great times when you have a lot of free-to-play games. A lot of people like hating them. For a reason, okay, but still it's, you know, it's a blessing to have a lot of high quality projects and even just like fun stuff to kill your time with. So yeah, what else? I think right after the school, I joined this university, the same university that my parents graduate from. So I'm a programmer, but... To be honest, I was never in love with the programming. And when I think about a career as a programmer, so I'm not feeling, you know, inspired. And I graduate like with really, really good grades, but I was not feeling that I want this path for me.
Sure.
And back in the day, so I have, you know, three main things in life that I really appreciate and love is my family, it's music, and the video games. And back in the day, I really was into music, so I play in the metal band, let's say, so we like tour around the country, and was like, okay, I will just, you know, hang out and see what's going on. And I was really into music, then I switched to electronical music, then I like was a promoter of my own parties and in Kharkiv. So it was like really fun times, but through all that time I play a lot. So it was, you know, it was something that video games are my friends, to be honest. Video games are great because it's, you know, it's obviously it's like an escapism.
Mm-hmm.
You're just living parallel life. If I can say that.
True, living a fantasy of...
Yeah, living a fantasy, but I think it's a great, great thing to have in life, because also back in the day, it was like a lot of hustle around the games. It's really bad for your education. It's like provoking the aggression and et cetera. And like, you know, the game of my life and the thing, the game that really changed me as a person... It's like the Doom, the like classical shooter. And it was like times when they said that, oh yeah, it's like, it's really bad game because, you know, you're killing monsters. Like, what are you doing? But okay, I'm just playing the game. I'm just fulfilling my desires. I don't know, but I'm not an aggressive person.
It's fun. It's a thrill.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of that narrative, I remember, when I was going to school as
yeah,
well.
Yes.
What are you doing? You're wasting your time playing those games.
Yeah, you're wasting your time. Yeah. And also, so my parents was telling me all the time that it's like, it's not serious. What are you doing? You not even wasting your time, but it's like, it's not serious. It's not something that you can do for a living or something. And like, I grew up with this mindset. And so... Then I can say that it was a really important moment. So I met my wife and we started living together. And one day she said to me like, "And you play a lot. Maybe you want to try yourself at the game industry." And you know, it may sound stupid, but it was like a huge insight for me. I never asking myself this question. And I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah, why not? Because it's like, it was, you know, it was crazy paradigm in my head.
True.
That like everyone is saying, like before everyone is like, it's not serious, it's something stupid enough and everything. And I was like, okay, I will give it a try. And I started as a game designer. And also since I have a background as in the music, I also start to doing sound design, and it's really helped me a lot to get new projects. I start with my friends as like outsource.
So you started your own company first?
Or it was not my company. So it was a company of my friend, but yeah, I work with him and we develop like small casual games for different companies. So it was like outsourcing.
Okay.
Also, we work remotely for some, you know, companies. And so I started to learn game design. And as I said, I was not inspired by programming, but I was really, really inspired by, you know, creating designs and everything. And I recall my, you know, memories from the childhood when I play in the games and I'm thinking, okay, what can I change in this game? What can I add? I was into like a lot of editors. I was creating the like Counter-Strike levels and like, so it was, you know, all the time, but I was...
So you were unconsciously so preparing yourself for that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I was never thinking about like, maybe I should give a try and do something. So yeah, and from the start I know a lot, so I have a lot of experience with different games and I have experience with different editors and like strong background in the programming. So yeah, my first experience was like almost totally remote, like, and you know, In 2 and 3 years, I felt like I want to work with a team. I really miss this offline communication. I want, you know, this professional network. I want I want to go to the office. I want, you know, to have chat with an art guy and like with a developer, with a tester, so I was hungry for for offline communication. And I think I quickly found my first offline job. I was a game design reverse engineer. So in fact, I was like playing the competitors and I was like reversing their design too. So I play the game, I document everything, like how they build their tutorial, how the first time user experience look like. And, you know, in my opinion, the reverse engineering is one of the best ways to understand and to learn game design. Because when you're trying to understand how the scenes work, when you like deconstructing it and like by little pieces and understand the system behind it and understand like how it's working, mm-hmm. it really, really helps to create something. And then that company, it was also a company that creating the casual games. It was, I think, more than 10, 12 years ago. So it was like the time when the King released the Candy Crush and everything. Okay. And it was like a huge, huge wave of the casual games and everyone like was hyped. It was the times of the Farm Hero saga from the King. So a lot of different match three games.
Mm-hmm.
And rapidly in that company, I think in 4 months, if I'm not mistaken, the CEO came to me and said like, okay, I think we need a game designer on that like dedicated project and we think that it will be you. And I'm like, okay, great. And after, if I'm not mistaken, also like 4 months, the producer on the project then working on left the company and there was nobody to replace them. So I can't say that I was a producer, but some part of the job was on me eventually.
Sure.
And it was, you know, really, really great time for me. I really appreciate this experience. The game failed in the end and I really, really appreciate it. But because like in general, I think success is not about the win. Is about the failure, about the experience, repetition, you know, and going forward. So,
how long did you have to work on it?
On that project, I think I worked for 8 months.
Okay.
So, I think first 4 months was honeymoon period when we finished everything, and then we launched the project, and the KPIs weren't there, and we start to A/B. Testing a lot. I create a lot of like levels for the first episode, for the like first time user experience, for the onboarding. And yeah, I think 4 months of struggling and they think about we need to close this project.
Right.
And for me, as I said, it was really, really great experience. I really appreciate it. I think, you know, everyone should have at least, you know, one failure or even more because you can learn a lot from that. And you can learn not only about the game, you can learn about yourself. And if you're, I don't know, if I can say if you're smart enough and if you're like motivated enough, you can improve yourself from that. So yeah, and right after that, I think, okay, I want to do something else. I want to try to give it a try. And to be honest, it's the casual games was not the thing that I really want to do. Mm-hmm. I always enjoyed playing casual games. It's super fun experience. And I always appreciate, you know, the simplicity of the core gameplay and the level of engagement that this simple mechanics can create. But as I said, I was a hardcore gamer when I was young. And I really want to have something else and something more, let's say, mid-core.
Sure.
So, yeah, and one more time, I'm a lucky guy. I have a huge company in my home city. It's Plarium. I work at the Plarium right now. And back, I think I start to work at the Plarium in 2014, if I'm not mistaken. And I have some friends there already working for like a year or two. And it was a really strange situation there. So they have around 300 or 400 employees at the moment.
Okay.
They have, I think, 3 or 4 successful social strategies, like Forex strategies already. But they have this strange vision, to my taste. They don't have game designers. So all the game design job was done by the like general manager and a really, really great, smart guy from the BI team. And, you know, when I...
It's pretty impressive to do that.
It's pretty impressive. Those two guys are like, they my heroes, you know. They legends. They really, really smart and they really... So they awesome. I'm a lucky guy that I met them and I have a chance, you know, to mm-hmm. learn from them. But when I hear that from my friend, I saw that, like, first of all, it's really strange. And second of all, like, I saw an opportunity there. Because, come on, guys, it's like the game design. So you're doing games, you're doing, like, huge, complicated Forex strategies, and you don't have dedicated game designer. And I'm already was, like, familiar with the game design, mm-hmm. and I understand, like, what can I, you know, add to the company? So I start to work in Plarium as a project manager because they don't have game designers. But it was so great, you know, they have the project managers at that time have a lot of responsibility and a lot of like, they took a lot of product decisions. And in general, so if you want to do it, you can do it. The game design is a project manager. So you have everything to do it. And so I started working and I saw that I have everything. So no one is stopping me from that. So it was like, it was not a dictatorship from those two guys.
Sure.
So they were really, you know, open and they came with ideas and I start to bring them designs and I start to ping pong the ideas and I start to, if I can say, you know, build my reputation. And quickly things changed. So I was start working with business performance guys that were really close to the product. Mm-hmm. They working on the game KPIs. They like suggest to they have some recommendation based on the analytics. And so it was I was still the project manager, but I can't even say I think it was something between the game producer and the like game designer. And I work on the 5 strategies simultaneously, so it was the games were really similar, but they have the different setting.
Okay.
But like if we're designing a feature, we're designing this feature for like all 5 strategies. And every game, so in general they're really similar, but every game has, you know, own uniqueness and like own tweaks in the core on the design. So you need to think about it and, you know, you need to deliver the right design for each one of them. But on the other hand, it was really insightful because a lot of data, a lot of like analytics, and I fell in love, you know, in this part of my work. Mm-hmm. I work a lot with data now, and I'm really data-driven guy, to be honest. So I think data is really, really important.
At one point, you know that the project is going to fail, or is it going to succeed? And how do you test it? Like, where do you get the data from?
Like, I think in general, in the free-to-play business, we have this brilliant opportunity to soft launch the games. So you can publish the game even not on the on your company's account, mm-hmm. on some like fictional company or even like from developer. You can soft launch it for a certain country, and then sure. you can collect the data. You can bring some traffic, so you can acquire users there, and we call it soft launch. It's really, it's a huge benefit in the game industry. I think in the free-to-play industry, mm-hmm. in comparison, like for the now film industry, for the cinema, you're working on the project for, I don't know, for 2 years, and then it's a premiere, all cinemas, and if your film sucks, it's, sorry, seems to be the hardest word. So, but in our case, and the same story, by the way, with the paid games. So mm-hmm. you're working on, you know, huge title for 7 years, you put in everything there, and okay, guys, something went wrong, or maybe your competitor was launched more successful project with like bigger marketing and everything. And
yeah, or they just did it earlier than you.
Yeah,
without you
knowing. So. And in the mobile industry, in the free-to-play industry, we have this crazy benefit to run this soft launch. So we do it a lot when we're collecting data and we're polishing the project. We're trying to, in the end of the day, free-to-play industry, it's just a, like, you know, from one hand, is creating the experience, is delivering the really fun and engaging experience for the players. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's like, it's a business. You have this KPIs, you know, what's your marketing CPI, what's your cost per install, then you know, your LTV, the lifetime value for the player, and you know, the like, IRPPU, average revenue per paying user, average revenue per user, and you can understand, so are you profitable or not? And if not, you can try to change it, mm-hmm. you can iterate, you can, you know, you can find some hypothesis, developed it, and you can get the proof of concept, or you can fail. But you have this really, really huge benefit of you know, of testing everything. And I think tons of projects, even they stay in this soft launch phase, and a lot of companies just killing it, and that's it. We're, for now we're a huge company, we're not so flexible as like a smaller company, so we don't develop a lot of projects for sure. now. But like back in the days, we're developing like 3 to 4 per year. It's like different studios in different countries. But in general, yeah, that's how the scenes works in the free-to-play industry.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good business model. I think when it comes to like AAA industry, as you mentioned, working 6-7 years on a project and you're launching it and it fails.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you spend more money making it than you actually make back. You know,
yeah, exactly. And in our free-to-play world, I know, you know, this ROAS, the return of advertisement spend. So we can calculate everything, and we can go to the like CEO, stakeholders, and say like, okay, guys, it will be a profitable game or not. And it's really like obvious. Yeah, definitely scenes could change, and like, it's a typical thing that when you start scaling projects, when you like increase the amount of new users, the CPI is like increasing. So, and in general, the more user you acquired, the worse CPI they have. So the worse the KPIs they have. So like, you're, as we like to set your first user, your golden cohort, is the best users that you will have, like, for this game in general. And then you will just have this decrease in every KPI.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Going back to your Plarium days when you were in Kharkiv, what was kind of a game changer moment for you, kind of working as a game designer in that company, that it felt, okay, like, this is me, I really want to do this, I really want to kind of grow in my career, continue with this, and, you know, I'm actually, like, very good at this as well. Like, was there, like, a project where you, like, super successful, that you did really well in, that you just kind of changed everything for you?
You know, I have this feeling that I'm not sure that I feel that I'm really good at that stuff. And I'm always saying that I need to perform better, that I need to learn more. So I think I'm underestimating myself. Like, it's hard to live with that feeling, but in general, I think it helped me to really improve in the end of the day. But if we will talk about my past in Plarium, to be honest, I think from the start, it was so fun and it was so interesting to work there, because you have a lot of things that you could do and no one will say, like, man, stop, it's not your responsibility. So I feel like through all my career in Plarium, I feel that I can do a lot of stuff and everyone is trying to help me, honestly, so I'm really, in general, I'm super involved in the game industry. And before Plarium, I started the independent conference in Kharkiv, like indie dev conference. And for the first years in Plarium, I continued to organize events. And then I just quit because, like, I was super engaged in the work. But I had a lot of projects in Plarium, not only like in my projects that I'm working on. We have, like, for example, we have the game jams that, you know, at one point I came to guys that was responsible for the events and etc. And I was like pushing idea, we should, you know, start to doing game jams because it's fun, it's engaging, we're a gaming company, it's really, it will motivate our employees, it will motivate team to do something, and it could be really interesting, and you know, it could be really valuable experience for everyone. And also we have this events that's like it was a tech talks, it was like some sort, it was not a conference, so it was the event with only one speaker. But also I was like a part of it, so I was super super engaged in the like culture and the company life and everything. But if we will back at the project, I think it was a moment when, so I work, I think, you know, when I felt that okay, I'm on the right track. It was a moment when my manager came to me and said, okay, we have a green light to create a game design department. You will be a game designer and you will be the game design team lead. And so we have, my first team was like, if I'm not mistaken, 7 people, 4 or 5 game designers, technical writer, UX guy, and analytic.
Okay. Were you the first game designer that Plarium kind of employed or created?
So
the
it was
for?
Like, you know, everyone, so not everyone, like 5 people at the same time became game designers, and I was the game design team lead.
Okay.
So I think it's, you know, I really appreciate the team and I really appreciate this level of trust from the company. But yeah, it was a start of the game design department, and this department grew a lot since that time. So we start in a number of 7 people, and I'm not sure, but I think when the COVID starts, we have a lot of 70 people there. So we like grow 10 times. in general. And in the game design department, we have like the analytics dedicated team. Then we have a branch of the technical writers team. Then we have, since I have this experience in game design reverse engineer, we have an idea to, you know, we need to know what happens in the market. We need to understand trends. We need to understand like which features our competitors releasing,
sure,
how they work, are they work good or not. And we start this initiative. We start a team of game researchers. And so guys and girls like playing competitors, they doing this competitive research, they understanding how the features work, they documenting everything, they like follow the live op schedule. So I think, yeah, it was that moment when one company showed that, okay guys, let's rock. You have everything to do it. And I think for me it was a great, great moment that showed me that I have a like really, really great opportunity to do something interesting and to do something big in company. So, and also I think it was a moment, if I'm not mistaken, the COVID already like hits everyone. And I have a meeting with my manager and he suggests me to start to become a game director on this project. And it was like, you know, it was an incredible opportunity because it's an action game. It's something that I really love and that I'm really, you know, into. And it's really it was a next step for me because with this strong background in the game design, I'm always, you know, hungry for new and into. Since the free-to-play industry, the free-to-play games is like, it's a business. And I really want to understand how everything works to you know, to be able to deliver the really great results and to be able to understand what should we do to improve the situation or, sure, or why the situation is not so good. And once again, what we can do. So, yeah, I think those two moments were really, really important for me. And they showed me that I have everything in that company to do something great. So, yeah.
Is that when you moved to Barcelona?
Not exactly. So, I moved to Barcelona 10 months ago.
Okay.
So, before that, we lived for a year in Warsaw, in Poland. And in fact, I was never thinking about leaving my country because I have everything that I want in Ukraine. I have, you know, this strong networking connection. I have this. So I host events. I was like a jury on the game jams, on the Indie Dev Cups. So
sure.
I was really involved in the gaming industry in the Ukraine. But then war started and I was forced to leave the country.
What happened to everybody on the team at Plarium?
Oh, you know,
most of them managed to, or I don't know, if you can share like,
yeah,
any stories.
Yeah, sure.
Or...
So the situation is really difficult because some of the team still in Ukraine, some of them like big amount of... employees in Plarium in general in Warsaw.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just like throughout the Europe. And once again in my life, I really miss this offline, you know, teamwork because after all those COVID years, after like this 2 years in solitary, in this, you know, totally remote world with sure. this... So I think my personal experience of COVID, so I'm really engaged in my work. I really love it. And it was hard for me to stop working because, you know, when you going out of the office, you're already switching to something else. You're on your way home, you're thinking about like other stuff. And when you're sitting at home, so I work a lot. I work a lot. And at one point, I understand that, okay, I need to, to rest somehow. And it's really hard to rest when you're locked in your apartment.
For sure.
But yeah, it was not so strict in Ukraine. And also I live near the forest. So I think it helps me a lot, to get lost in the woods. So yeah, but I think a couple of months before the war, we start to go to the office and I push everyone. So all of my game design team was at the office. So we're living again in the office.
Finally.
And then the war started and it was a crazy. The first month was really crazy because the project is live. So the live ops schedule is running. So we need to maintain the project. We need to, if we reschedule the releases, mm-hmm. it's okay. But still the players need to do something. We need to launch events. So the team is super great. They did the best job that they can do, I think. And yeah, the first months were really, really tough. But then, it's hard to say, but everyone is get used to it. They figure out how to manage everything.
Where did you guys work from? And how?
It depends. It depends because, to be honest, we have a lot of different stories because. The Kharkiv is the eastern part of Ukraine, and Ukraine is a pretty huge country, really, really huge. And so my wife was pregnant when the war started.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was an experience for me. And so my obvious decision, we jump in the car and we went to the western part. We went to a border. And so I quickly team up with one of my best friends, my game designer buddy, and we live in the mountains and house in the beautiful place. The time was not beautiful, but the place was really, really beautiful. But, if we're talking about the team and the people in general, I have a lot of different stories. For example, one of our QA, not on my project, but on the other project in our company. He was in one of the towns near the Kharkiv, and it was he don't want to leave. And the Russians are approaching his town and mm-hmm. they get closer and closer, and in chat he was okay, they shelling my house. So he sit in the underground under his house,
A basement.
Yeah, in the basement. Yeah, thanks. In the basement, and so it was crazy. And everyone is man, you need to move out. It's really dangerous. And he sit, I don't know, for 4 months there, if I'm not mistaken. And then everyone is pushing, and he finally left, and everything was okay. But I know a lot of tough stories, and it's really hard. It was really hard to work in this first months, but to be honest, it's still really hard to live in this strange time when every night, almost every night, they fire in rockets, and you never know where. So they said that they shell in the military infrastructure.
Yeah.
But in fact,
it's not the case.
Yeah, it's not the case. So it's hard to say, to be honest, but a lot of people get used to it. It's really, really tough to say it. But still, I think, the level of stress is really, really high. So yeah, it's really, it's hard to see those people, and we all trying to support each other, and everyone is like super engaged in this volunteers project. Like everyone is donating, everyone is trying to buy something, like in Europe, to pass it. So the company, since like 2014, the company is really involved in helping the like Ukraine military forces and everything. Okay. But like from the very beginning of the war, everyone was like super involved. And for example, we have a huge office in Kharkiv. And for, I think like even to this day, the office was a shelter. So we have a parking lot. And they create, you know, this shelter. They create this space with like washing machines, with a bed. So, and
all right, okay.
So it was like a couple of months where I think 100 people just lived there. So, and they firing rockets and they shooting artillery on the Kharkiv, and like they just live in the office and they work from the office. So it.
But how are you not scared? So you live in the office. The shells are.
I don't know. I think
how'd you not scared that it might hit the office as well?
In fact, they hit a building near the office.
Okay.
It was a tennis court. And the couple of windows are like, was totally, you know, trashed.
Crazy.
But to be honest, you know, it's a strange feeling when everything was started. So when this full invasion, so me personally, I can't believe it. So, and before the war, everyone was like hyped with all this like information that, okay, maybe they will start this invasion and everything. And my wife was pregnant and I was, you know, I was trying to be chill. So I was like, guys, calm down. So everything will be okay. If you're really, so my position was, I was telling my team, if you're really, you know, felt that you not in the safe place, if you're really scared, just, you know, move out the town or the country. We are totally okay with that. It's like the post COVID times, remote work is totally okay for us. So the main priority for us and for company and for me, it's like, you know, the well-being of the team. And so I was trying to be this, you know, chill dude.
Sure.
And when everything was started, it was, I can't say I was shocked, I think. I was, you know, in this survival mode. So 24th of February, 5 in the morning, we heard that the shelling starts. We came out of the balcony and I just saw, you know, how the rockets flying and, you know, the scene is just blowing. And like we grab our notebooks, we grab our like passports, everything, and like in the hour we was in the car heading the west. So yeah. Sure.
So you had everything prepared just in case.
No, really? I was, as I said, I was a chill dude. So okay. I was like, everything will gonna be okay. So it was, you know, yeah, everyone like was, you need to be prepared, you need to have this packed, and I'm like, guys, everything will be okay. So yeah, we quickly packed our backpacks, we grab everything, and yeah, I grabbed my wife.
Crazy.
So yeah, it was really, really crazy time. But as I said, unfortunately, the war is not over.
I can't believe it's been lasting for such a long time. It's been 2 years now.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when it started as well. I mean, it's like the whole world stopped. I mean, everyone was just watching the news and seeing, you know, looking what's going on.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And it, as you said, the COVID just finished.
Yeah.
You think you're like, okay, the world is back to normal.
Yes.
And then the war starts.
Yeah, and it was a huge challenge, you know, to try to back in life. And the company tried to help everyone with that. They like, we have like dedicated budget to mental health. And we have like sessions with different specialists that like, you know, they learned us like how to cope with everything.
Sure.
They teach us. So yeah. the challenge is still like life. So
how did you move to Barcelona eventually from Poland?
You know, when the pregnancy has this, the doctor's giving this estimation of birth. And when I finally got all my documents and I crossed the border, it was 5 days prior to the estimation of like baby delivery. And my plan was, I thought, or I want to go to the Lisbon because we have a lot of co-workers there. Or I want to go to the Barcelona because I really love the city. Like, I was at my 30th birthday, I was here for the first time. I was at the Primavera Fest. So it was like, it was amazing. The city is awesome. I fell in love, like, and I really, really, I was here like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, I think. And it was an open question for me, like Lisbon or Barcelona. But since it was like, you know, 5 days prior to the delivery, and I just imagine, okay, what if we were in our car and my wife will start delivering the baby, like in the middle of nowhere? And then I think, okay, for me, it's like, it will be huge, like experience. And for her, it will be like really, really.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to
tough.
Risk that. Yeah.
Yeah. And we decide to stay in the Warsaw to deliver a baby. And so we deliver a baby, not in the 5 days and 21 days, but since still it's like, it's an estimation, you know, every sure. estimate is, you know, muscle manas. Yeah. We deliver a baby and we live for a year in Warsaw because we just rent a flat for a year and you can't break the contract.
Yeah.
So, and in the end of this period, I start to, you know, try this process of finding the apartment here. And it's really hard to find a good apartment in Barcelona. I think you know it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I move by myself in a car and my wife flew with a daughter. And yeah, we just start here a new life, I think. The Warsaw is really awesome. It's a great place, great country, great place, great people. And the city is really, really awesome. It's really green and modern. So it's like some people even call the Warsaw like the European New York because of their business center.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, since we live the country, in fact, Poland is really similar to the Ukraine in terms of the culture. We're really close. We're really, really close. And since we live the country, we want, you know, different experience. If we need to start new life, I think we should find a great place to start it. And in my opinion, Barcelona is one of the best places to live in Europe, to be honest. The great weather, the great people, a lot of like companies, and I really enjoy the community here. It's so cool to have a lot of events, to have a lot of meetups here. So I really fell in love with this, you know, community vibe here, because
for sure
this, I think they have everything except the game design, by the way. So I have even thoughts, maybe I need to start this game design live ops meetups, because
I feel like it definitely lacks.
Maybe.
I've been having the same thought.
So yeah, we have this like product meetups, we have the UX, we have the, I don't know, marketing, and we have the developers, we have the analytics. And every time I try to search like something about the game design or live ops, and there's nothing there.
Yeah, games industry in general, I mean, there's not that much going on.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. But in general, Barcelona is a great place to live in. And as I said, you know, the community here is really, really open and really positive about everything. So it's really great to be here. It's really great to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I have the same feeling. I moved here during COVID, and it was strange to see how quiet it was.
Oh, yeah. I heard about it.
But I feel like, yeah, I mean, not even now, but probably like a couple of years ago when COVID finished, I mean, it all started to come back to normal. And as you said now, I mean, it's just a lot happening every day. And you never get bored with the city. You always discover new places, new restaurants, new places to go and meet new people.
Yeah. And the one thing I really love about Barcelona, the barrio, every district have this own vibe.
True.
And, you know, you can just cross the street and there's like, you know, something new here. So, yeah, it's really, really great place to live in.
What do you play currently? What games do you play? You mentioned you play a lot, but tell me.
Oh, okay. So, if we'll talk about the, for example, console games, I play, obviously, Helldivers.
Okay.
For democracy, you know, I'm killing bugs for democracy. So, yeah. I think it's a great game. I think guys really, besides all the bugs that they have, and I think it's a crazy times for them, I think they are fixing bugs like, I don't know, 24/7. I think they deliver a great co-op experience, and I always love cooperative games. I think, you know, every game could be great if you're playing with friends. It's like, it's something that's so obvious for me. I really love to spend time with my friends in cooperative games and like maybe PvP games, but still, like if you're playing with someone and it's not just a random dude from like from the internet, it's your buddy, it's more fun and engaging.
Sure.
I'm playing a lot of games on the mobile. I'm playing like competitors. Now we're in the middle of like new projects, so I will not tell everything about it, but I play a lot of, you know, so I have this rule, I try to play new releases, so I just go and see what's new on the store. Also, I try to keep my eye on the games that growing fast. And obviously, I think super trend now is a hybrid casual games, like The Last War, Top War, the Whiteout Survival, these games that manage to, I don't know, trick the system with this hybrid casual approach when they create this casual onboarding and when they look like a casual game. And they manage to have really low CPIs because of that. But they hide in really, really deep and complex game behind this onboarding. And because of that, they have like crazy amount of revenues. So if you will take a look at this, I don't know, Last War or Whiteout Survival, they growing months over months, like 10 millions a month. And yeah, it's really, I can't say it's something new. It's already like, I think last year was a breakout of this new hybrid casual approach.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the landscape of industry, of free-to-play industry is changing because the competition is too high. The competition in terms of like the game quality is super high. So it's not 2012 or 2014 when you know, create a great game and everyone is like, wow, we will install it. And for example, do you know Subway Surfer?
Yeah.
For example, last month, they have 16 millions of downloads and they're not...
Last month?
Yeah, last month. So I think it's...
They've been around for...
It's a phenomenon. It's like a Tetris. I think... They have it because, you know, people buying the tablet and they, okay, what I should download? Okay, Subway Surfers, I know it, so.
Right, okay. Now
it's like, it's some, and we don't have much games like that. So now the competition is super high in terms of marketing also. So in terms of, first of all, in terms of the game's quality. And if you want to, you know, deliver something really, really good, I think even 5 years before, you can, it will be enough to to develop a great game with a great, like, I can say AAA mobile game with a great graphics, with like great gameplay, and okay, it will work. The great game with a great, like, assets will find the spot in the top grossing chart. But now, with also with all these crazy Chinese companies, they delivering like super, super high quality because they have, you know, a lot of, they have huge teams and they working, I don't know, 10 hours, 6 days a week. And they just, it's really,
they just,
yeah, yeah,
them nonstop.
Yeah. But also in terms of marketing, it's super hard to achieve the success. For example, if I'm not mistaken, last year we have plus 50% of the advertisers. So it's a lot. And since the advertising is an auction, is they have bids, they buy in the advertising, it means that the CPI went up, like in general. And if the CPI is higher, then it means that your game and your monetization and your retention should be like higher. And it's really hard, you know, to create just, for example, if CPI like increased like 2 times, for example, not because you did it, because like of the market, it's really hard to go to your game designers and say like, okay, guys, you need to improve your monetization like for 200%. It's not working like that. Yeah, definitely we have this crazy issue with the Brawl Stars when they have like a lot of complex changes and they increase revenues six times, 600% in a month. But it's a unique situation. In general,
it doesn't happen like that. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Sometimes you get these phenomena that come out and people just play it for God knows what reason. So let me see what games I have on my phone. I can tell you. So I've got, these are my games. You can take a look at it. I've got, I think, Talking Tom, because my child.
Oh, yeah.
My child plays it. I've got Monument Valley.
You have great games. The Pac-Man, the Mario, the Galaxiga. I really like it. It's the old school vibe. I will take my phone and that will, if you want, I can just drop some names.
Go for it. Like, I'm not big on playing mobile games.
Yeah.
I usually play when I'm traveling. So when I'm on a plane or on a train or whatever, that's when I...
So, okay, it's... As I said, I have, you know, this rule to download a lot of games, to play it and to delete it. And I try to come back to a game, to a certain games, like in 3 months, in 6 months, to see what happens. So, for example, what I have here is, okay, if we're talking about like something interesting, I have Hades. Hades is a like recent release on the mobile. It's a great game. I play a lot of Hades on the Nintendo Switch.
Okay.
But I think it's something also unique. But also, I have the Warframe, I have Farlight 84, I have Arena Breakout, I have Watchers of the Realms, Frozen City, Whiteout Survival.
Okay.
Call of Duty Warzone, like, came a couple of days ago.
Is that made by King? Is that their...
It's an Activision game, yeah.
But did King make it, or did...
To be honest, if we would talk... If the question is who developed
the mobile game,
it's the Asian guys.
Oh, okay.
And the Call of Duty Mobile also developed by Asian guys. And the fun story here is if we will took 3 really, really popular games, popular shooters on the mobile, PUBG, Call of Duty Mobile, and Apex Legends, they already closed the game, but still... These 3 games developed not by the same company, but the companies that Tencent owned this company. So I can say that It's okay. The same. They have the same engine. So as I said, the Asian guys are really, really...
They're doing it.
Yeah, they're doing it. So, and also, what else I have? For example, I'm checking out the Heroes versus Hordes. And I also have this Blade Idol, Top Heroes, Idol Miner. So, Attack Hole, Overcrowded, Unsolved Case, Last Day on Earth. It's this really, really old game. And I just want to, you know, understand, oh, you're alive. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And Total Battle, also a great example of this hybrid casual approach. So, it's a different genres. And as I said, you know, for a game designer... And like, I think not even for a game designer, for everyone from the game industry, you need to be familiar with, and you need to have a lot of different experiences. It's like, you know, it's like a wine. The more you taste, the more you know, the more you understand,
sure,
the better. So same story here. It's like, in the end of the day, I think it's all about the user experience. It's like, it's smooth, seamless, it's you know, it's pleasant, it's like fun, it's engaging, or maybe not. It's like, it's buggy, it's, I don't know, it's design dumb, and
you can't play it straight away.
Tutorial
is too long,
you
or
have
something.
This, you know, tutorial that you can skip, and you just, yeah, or it's like not obvious what to do in it, and you just stuck, and you just, okay, I will delete the game. And what, as I said, since the free-to-play games are really, really like business oriented. For example, in that case, if I install the game and I delete it, what if I like see the ad and install the game? So I do this install, so the companies already pay for me, and I just delete the game just because you're designed strange, like strange funnel, strange experience for the user, and you just lost me. So It's just a lost opportunity for your business.
I guess that's the downside of free-to-play, right? If you pay for the game, even if it's like €5 or €6, you download it, you keep it, you try and make it work. But if it's free-to-play, you're like, it's just annoying.
Yeah. And I think it's a huge benefit of free-to-play games. And also, I think it's one of the reasons why the paid games are really stable. They have these genres, and we don't have much. Yeah, definitely we have a huge indie scene, and we have, you know, this really like big amount of interesting project. But if we will take a look at something, you know, with the popular games, the like the scene that everyone knows about, it's pretty stable. And in mobile free-to-play games, everything is changing because we are KPI driven, we are data driven, we know what features working and which features are not working. We know like how to motivate players to do something with like live ops events, mm-hmm, and this experience is changing, as I said, the landscape of the mobile game industry itself. So I think if we will take a look at the games, I don't know, 10 years ago on the consoles, it was the same games, but with like worst quality. I mean, the visuals and not much of a new mechanics, of new approaches, of like new everything. And if we'll take a look at the mobile industry, 10 years in the mobile industry, it's like a centuries. Because 10 years ago, I think everyone is saying like, it's unreal that action games on the mobile will be popular. You can't play action games. How you will like aim and how you... It's not realistic. And like now, they have all this multimillionaire franchise and a lot of, you know, a lot of schoolboys and girls playing all these games. So,
and basically like carrying a console in your pocket now. I mean, the phones are so powerful, they're so much more powerful, and God knows what's going to be in 10 years. I mean, if you look at the consoles come out, what, every 5 years, every 6 years? So the games don't change that much. but for
definitely
for not that often, whereas for mobile, you have new phones coming out
I think we have a problem with console because I think consoles want to be mobile phones. They want to release consoles more like often to sell them. But in general, you're totally right. There's like not much things changing in that game. So if we're talking about the fidelity, the realism of the games, it's like, maybe the facial expressions are much, much like better now. But in terms of everything else, I don't know. It's the same Assassin's Creed. It's the same Call of Duty. And I really enjoyed the Call of Duty 10 years ago. And it's the same Call of Duty in the end of the day. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting what we will have in the 10 years. Because, for example, like the latest iPhone, they even presented the Resident Evil 4 on the iPhone 15, mm-hmm. and they also have they also announced the Division, the like awesome game from the console that I really enjoyed on the console, and like, okay, it will be on the mobile phone. Are you serious? And even the Kojima's Death Stranding on the phone. Yeah, the quality is not so good, but still, guys, you're like, you played Snake 20 years ago on the Nokia, and now you're playing something you like spectacular. I can't even imagine how the youngsters feel nowadays.
There's so much choice. There's just so much like an abundance of choice. And as well with Netflix coming with mobile names as well, that you can download there. Like you can download GTA Vice City now. On Netflix.
Yes, exactly. And the Hades, the game that I told about, it's also a Netflix release. So yeah, they try to grab their own piece of success. And in the end of the day, so I think 5 years ago, there was, idea that we are fighting in the mobile games, we are fighting for the screen time. We have this competition not only with the mobile games. We have this competition with Netflix and with YouTube, with other platforms. And I think now everyone is understand that, okay, we're fighting not even for the screen time with Netflix. We're fighting with the time with your family, with dinner in the restaurant, and everyone is want to engage you more, to motivate you to come back, and everyone is creating these patterns how to retain this retention of the players.
Sure.
I think, as I said, youngsters nowadays is really have this challenge with their phones. I think it will be hard to understand that you're addicted, I think. Because everyone is now trying, like not in the games, but everyone is trying to use the gamification.
Mm-hmm.
Even like in the supermarkets, in the Carrefour, they have this like something, the points and the loyalty programs, and everyone is using it. So, and I think because it's working, everyone is using it. And in 10 years, we can only imagine.
When it comes to leadership, so you've been a lead for a long time. You've been leading teams, you're a game director.
Yeah.
Now, how did your leadership style change? Have you always, you feel like you've always been the same when it came to leading teams? And, what kind of leader are you, if you think about it?
So, I think my leadership style changed a lot. So, I try to inspire people. And I really try to give them, it's always a balance. It's always a challenge to keep this, to have this clear goals and maybe to have some limits. But for me, it's super important to create this environment when you have ability to do something, when you understand that your input is valuable, when you feel that you are responsible for something. And before that, so for me personally, it was really hard to change my mindset from like a lone survivor from I do everything by my own. Mm-hmm. I'm responsible for myself to this mindset, because I think, you know, it's really important to trust your team. It's really important to support them, even in the hard times. And as I said, I believe in failure. It's great to do mistakes. And when someone is failing, it's always interesting to see how this person will
blossom eventually. And
yes, mm-hmm. And it's really important to create this safe environment for your team, for everyone, to give them opportunity to fail and learn something. But on the other hand, you operate in the business, and we have this monthly targets and everything, so we just can't, you know, lose everything in the months because everyone is learning something and everyone is True. Failing. So it's kind of a balance between trust and the freedom, and I think clear understanding of goals for everyone. And also, I also really, really love, you know, this feeling of limit, because if we were talking with like game designers, I'm totally, there's different stages of the game design. And when we are on the concept stage, like, we don't think about limits. We need to understand what are we doing, where, why it's cool. So it's really important to understand, to have this really great idea to be able to have this crazy fantasies, okay, it will like work that way, and we have like a lot of, I don't know, mobs, and we have this huge city, and et cetera, et cetera. But right after that, it's really important to understand, okay, guys, and how we will do it. So how we will put it in our restrictions, how we will do it with our resources, with our technologies. And for me, it's always an interesting time, because when you feel these limits, when you understand them, you can create something really spectacular. So yeah, it's a balance between, you know, creative freedom and understanding your responsibility. So, and I just love my work. I just love my team. I just love my project. It's really important for me to, you know, to be transparent with my team. It's really important if we take like some decision to, I don't know, to run this A-B test or to, I don't know. For example, we have this interesting situation in our project when we redesign our tutorial map. Mm-hmm. So eventually, in the couple of months, we understand that, okay, guys, we have the lower retention, and we start the investigation, and we saw that, okay, maybe it was some technical issues, maybe we like changed something with the release, and then we see that, okay, we have a strange like drop when the players play in this map, and someone have a hypothesis, maybe it's because of the redesign. And it's kind of strange, because in fact, like, we improved the map, we increased the quality of the assets and everything, but map was with a daylight lighting, and we do it on the like night, and someone is like, okay, let's do A-B test day versus night, and we like, okay, let's do it. And we saw that the night map has like 2% more churn users. And we like, okay, guys, seriously? So it's really strange, but
data tells you everything.
Yeah, but okay, who are we to, you know, to not trust the data? So yeah, and we like, okay, it's It's really interesting finding. So we returned the old map, and now we have the second iteration of, like, we're redoing this redesigned map with daylighting, and to compare the old daylight map with a new daylight map to understand, is it really just the dark environment create this churn for users? Mm-hmm. Or maybe, because it's a huge question, maybe it's, for example, it's more high quality assets, uses more the RAM of the devices, and we have the churn of, like, the low tier devices. And it's really hard to understand everything at the same time. So we're picking the suspect,
sure,
and going step by step. So yeah, crazy work. So yeah, and so for me, it's always important, to be transparent with the decision. So it's not about, like, okay, guys, we are taking off this map and that's it. Here's the task. You need to do it. So it's really important to tell the story to the team. I think it's affect the motivation and engagement, because you're feeling that you're working on the project, you're influence the project. And, this feeling that you're have power to change something.
Sure.
It's super important for everyone. I think it's the essential thing.
You feel some sort of ownership.
Yes, that's, definitely. It doesn't matter. I don't believe in, in positions and everything. Yeah, definitely there's some, like, bureaucracy about it. But still, it's not about your position. You're owner of your thing. And we all creating this unique experience, and you creating your part of it. But also, for example, in Plarium in general and in our project, it's really important that you can give your feedback to everyone. You can just say, guys, what are you doing? I think it's dumb, for example. And it's like, it's totally normal to have this conversation, because everyone is trying to be open. And this, I don't like this mindset when if you don't like something, you need to have a suggestion, like, what to do. Because it means that if you don't have a suggestion, but you still don't like something, you will not telling this.
Sure.
And it's really important for a team, for everyone to know that if you don't like something, or you don't understand something, or for example, you think that it's the bad experience, just and you don't know how to change it, but you are feeling it. And for example, we are not, because we are so deep in this, and we already not seeing scenes, because we're working on it for like half a year. It's just so important to be able to say, guys, I think it's strange. And maybe it will really help us to improve the overall experience. So yeah, I think these things are super important in terms of leadership for me. And I always love to work in competitive environment, but at the same time, in open and positive environment, when we can, just said what we think and sure. Be safe.
Sure. Cool. I mean, look, thank you so much.
Thank
you. For coming over. It was a pleasure. You can really talk. And it's super interesting. It's super interesting. So yeah, thanks so much, man. And
thank you, Thomas.
Hope we can do it again. Maybe sometime.
Yeah.
In the future.